Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. Before we start today's show, I just wanted to remind you that Hidden History is back and has returned for an all-new episode today, wherever you get your podcast out right now on the Hidden History feed. And it is going to be a pretty good one. On this week's episode, we're going to be talking about Guatemala, specifically the lead-up to kind of the beginning of this 40-year campaign in response to the presidency and the democratic election of Jacobo Arbenz, who really wanted to destroy, frankly, the decades and perhaps centuries-long systems of colonization, from massive land ownership to a few wealthy elites kind of owning all the land. And, you know, really, after that 1954 coup, Guatemalan democracy was kind of strangled in the cradle and kind of unleashed really a 40-year campaign of violence and repression of any kind of left-wing or kind of pro-democracy forces in the country, which really led to a pretty dark, dark situation. This episode specifically, though, part one, will be all really about the lead-up to that, the really history of it, going all the way back to, you know, the Monroe Doctrine and the sense of U.S. entitlement towards Latin America and kind of building up towards the rise and then eventual fall of Jacobo Arbenz. That being said, let's start today's show. All right, let's get into it. On the show today, we have some fresh news out from the jobs numbers, and it's looking pretty good. A big jump in job growth from 339,000 jobs added in the month of May. Pretty big news for the Biden administration, and a big question now goes to the Fed. What are they going to do about those interest rates when they meet in the middle of the next month? Should be very, very interesting. We'll get into what all the economists are saying and how people are reacting and kind of decode that for you and bring it back down to just normality and reality and kind of translate it from that econ speak. Also, the Senate has passed the debt limit bill, staving off what would have been a pretty calamitous default, but it is no victory, as Biden really, again, should not have been in a situation in the first place. It was a defeat that he really even got there and handed McCarthy all that leverage. But the bill has passed. We'll break it down and the consequences, of course, for you. Meanwhile, Ryan Grimm, The Intercept, is reporting on a very interesting dynamic between the FBI and kind of the United States government and Julian Assange in Australia. Australia has kind of been pressuring the United States to be a bit more lenient on the WikiLeaks founder, but the FBI has just reopened the case around Assange. Keep you all the latest on that to end the show. Yeah, and it's going to be a very interesting kind of game here, I think, right off the bat as we get into our first story, to see how many times the New York Times, which is definitely kind of, you know, obviously mainstream thinking, you know, I'm going to say it, establishment newspaper. You know, that should not be controversial. It is literally the establishment newspaper of probably the entire world, frankly. The paper of record, I guess you could say, or at least the Western world. You know, don't want to be too, you know, presumptuous there. But 339,000 jobs added in May is definitely a huge, huge deal. You know, definitely beating the last at least 3 months of jobs numbers. And right here, you know, if this were a drinking game, I think you'd be taking your first shot because it's the labor market continued to show resilience in May, adding many more jobs than expected, despite efforts by the Federal Reserve to cool the economy. And again, that is how they are explicitly phrasing it. They're saying what the Federal Reserve is trying to do is trying to get people out of work by raising these interest rates. That is the consequence that they're not going to be too open and public and honest about, but that is the consequence that they wanted it to have. And it so far, pretty much the big story of the Biden administration kind of underlying is that jobs have really kept up pace in a pretty remarkable level. You know, this quote-unquote labor shortage, you know, more and more jobs are being added. It is getting to be, the climate that they're hoping for, essentially, is not quite going into place. So U.S. employers added, again, 39,000 jobs, 339,000 jobs, excuse me, on a seasonally adjusted basis, the Labor Department said on Friday, an increase from a revised total of 294,000 back in April. The strong figures emerged from a survey of employers. A separate component of the report, based on the survey of households, yielded a somewhat dissonant picture. The data showed a rise in unemployment rate of the unemployment rate to 3.7% from 3.4%, and a decrease of 310,000 in the number of people employed as participation in the labor force was little changed. It's a sign that the pressure to entice workers with pay increases is easing. Wage growth slowed slightly in May, with the average hourly earnings increase 0.3% from April and 4.3% over the year. We're seeing a labor market that's gradually cooling at a glacial pace. I think that meant it said place, but I think it meant to be a pace there. A little typo from the New York Times, caught it. But anyway, yeah. Again, this is the dynamic that we're having because we started seeing it from the 2021. Kind of a consistent story all throughout to today's day and age, which is there has been a really kind of glut of workers who are now realizing pretty much more jobs than there are workers. So that pressure is really something the Fed is trying to fix by raising interest rates. And, you know, the wage growth is what the Fed's pausing here, is the wage growth is what is causing the inflation. The fact that, you know, workers after the pandemic, after, you know, kind of the, you know, jobs need to be filled back up, and the Federal Reserve, the workers were like, you know, we could have very easily, especially low wage growth, which has really been the strongest over this period, low wage growth has been, low wage workers have said pretty easily, you know, we will be able to find another opportunity. It will not be necessary for me to kind of come in and stay in this job where I am not going to be paid what I think is enough, and I can easily get paid more. It's kind of going down the street. You know, I could definitely in the Northeast, you know, speaking kind of anecdotally, it is definitely true that the $15 an hour is definitely kind of the benchmark, the standard, as the minimum wage is definitely trying to increase. But, you know, you don't see that many. Maybe it was kind of in late 2021, early 2022, but you don't see any kind of, like, outlandish offers of, like, oh, we're paying $20 an hour for you to work at McDonald's. Like, that is not the reality of what it was. I mean, there's just been a lot of lobbying. There's been a lot of efforts by the, you know, Federal Reserve to talk about, you know, and kind of responding to outrage from, you know, the small business and kind of just community, and really the big business community, and just anyone who's employing minimum wage workers to try and get this situation back on track. It's working to a certain extent. You know, the wage growth is kind of cooling off. And, you know, again, I love how this kind of phrase, you know, wage growth is cooling. You know, it's looking pretty good. You know, we don't have to worry about this too much. It's getting under control. You know, like, it's a pretty funny dynamic, to say the least, because, you know, wage growth, I think, should be pretty much always be a good thing, especially when corporate profits are nowhere near
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Especially the increase in corporate profits are nowhere near the increase in wage growth, especially over, you know, the last 10, 20, 30 years. You know, a few years with like 5 to 3% wage growth is not going to be the end of the world by any stretch. Yeah, but it seems that these stingy employers may not be quite off the hook just yet, as the hiring numbers are suggesting that employees across the spectrum remain eager for workers, even in the face of high interest rates and economic uncertainty, as some of these pressures are, you know, even though it may be harder to hire, you know, maybe take out loans to expand, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We are still seeing the businesses are like, you know, we need people, especially probably some of the bigger businesses, the more secure businesses are saying, we're going to just kind of hire people for sure. Many are still bringing on employees to meet steady consumer demand and kind of return of steady consumer demand, especially for services, rather than lay off workers, which would signal deeper cracks in the labor market. A large swath of companies also have been content to limit their headcount through attrition. An open question is whether employers can continue to rebuff economic challenges and for how long. While overall the jobs market performance has been surprisingly strong, I think the labor market can't defy the gravity of Fed rate hikes forever, said this economist here. Well, yeah, it's been doing pretty well so far. You know, every time you think it's a slowdown, every time, you know, because again, this is essentially admitting here, you know, nowhere in this is the reality of inflation. Nowhere in this is the reality of the fact that inflation has been really cooling, trending lower consistently. Whether the rate hikes are going up, you know, or they're kind of cooling off, you know, inflation has been going down even really before, you know, the rate hikes started. But inflation isn't even being talked about in this. It's all in relation to interest rates and unemployment, which really should tell you what the true goal of this is. You know, that should be the kind of clearest indication of what they're trying to do. Is they are trying to make people unemployed, make more workers come out of the workforce, be more desperate for work, and put the pressure off the employers to you know, maybe just maybe have to offer increased wages. You know, that is, again, what clearly here is causing some of the most consternation. The report complicates the picture for the Federal Reserve, which has been raising interest rates for more than a year to temper the labor market and rein in price increases. Again, look what comes first there. Temper that labor market, baby. Yeah, so when this economist says, I think the labor market can't defy the gravity of the Fed rate hikes forever, what he's essentially saying is, you know, unemployment is going to have to come up, people are going to have to be more desperate for work, and then they will not be able to demand any kind of increased power, any increased kind of higher wages. Like, we've seen workers report some of the highest satisfaction they have ever reported in the wake of the pandemic. Like, that is a big, big problem, these people, and it really kind of upsets how things were going prior to the pandemic, in a world that they would very, very much want to return to. And, you know, they are trying everything in their power. It so far has been relatively unsuccessful in the form of these interest rate hikes. They're trying everything in their power to return to that status. Meanwhile, though, President Joe Biden was pretty happy. He said, today's a good day for the American economy and American workers. He said the report brings the total number of jobs created while he was president to 13 million. How can job growth accelerate while the unemployment rate rises? Well, the two figures come from different surveys, one of businesses, the source of the monthly payroll figure, and one of households, the source of the unemployment rate. Over time, the two typically tell pretty consistent stories, but they can diverge in over any kind of given month. Often, the divergence is nothing more than noise, but sometimes it reflects that something real is happening in the economy. That's because the two surveys measure different things. Surveys of households, for example, includes gig workers and other people doing non-traditional jobs that are not counted in the business survey. So potentially some of that work has become more rocky over recent periods. That appears to be what happened last month. In May, unincorporated self-employment, which includes gig workers, independent contractors, and some small businesses, fell by 369,000, the third straight monthly decrease, which raised the overall unemployment rate. Looking just at people in more traditional jobs, employment rose in both surveys this past month. So, yeah, that's very, you got to wonder if it's a little bit, you know, some of this, what we've been hearing going down in Florida with the kind of lack of access to kind of immigrant labor and kind of less traditional labor. That's, you know, something that came to my mind. I don't know if that's, you know, no evidence to say that's just being kind of pure speculation, but, you know, we have been hearing a lot of stories about, you know, a lot of parts around the border, especially in Florida, that there has been a massive drop off some of this stuff. I bet there is some other factors going on as well, but just, you know, kind of one I have heard of as we move on to our next story.
This ain't what you want. This ain't what you want. You're listening to Newsflash right here on the Spencer Walsh Radio Network. Help us grow our audience. Subscribe, rate, and review our show on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. Thank you very much. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are getting into some pretty good news today, I guess, for, you know, Joe Biden, the broader American economy. But the Senate has passed its debt limit bill. Just went through the House and, you know, relatively quickly, you just got picked up in the Senate the next day. So the final vote came, again, after leaders put down a revolt by some senators who raised concerns the debt limit package would underfund the Pentagon. Oh, no. A pretty big moment for them. The bill passed in the Senate. This is what that sounded like. And then after that, we'll hear Chuck Schumer and what he had to say.
On this vote, the yeas are 63, the nays are 36. The 60-vote threshold having been achieved, the bill is passed.
Tonight's vote is a good outcome because Democrats did a very good job taking the worst parts of the Republican plan off the table. And that's why Dems voted overwhelmingly for this bill, while Republicans, certainly in the Senate, did not. Remember what House Republicans originally wanted when they showed us their plan, and compare it to the bill we're now sending to the president's desk. The difference is as stark as night and day. Republicans wanted to gut investments we made in the IRA and the Inflation Reduction Act that are driving a new generation of American manufacturing, billions and billions of investments, and thousands upon thousands of jobs. We fought and fought. That ain't happening. This demanded a bipartisan solution. We knew we'd need to come together for a solution like the one that passed tonight. And so I'm happy to stand here passing this critical legislation to support our families, preserve vital programs, and most importantly, avoid catastrophic default.
So there he is there, kind of getting, you know, just really, I think, with the bipartisan remark,
yeas
getting to the point of it.
314, the nays are
That's how it sounded passing in the House with the Kentucky Fried Chicken man. It literally looks like Colonel Sanders maybe in his late 40s is how I'd characterize him. Sounds like him too, but probably one of the people, I think one of McCarthy's kind of closest allies there, for sure. Schumer kind of did get to the point of the bill when he said this really was a bipartisan deal. Classic kind of newsflash rule, you know, a little bit of newsflash for you here, is when bipartisan compromise is used, it is often for the worst, whether it's, you know, spending more money for wars,
agreeing to cut welfare like they did in here. Literally, the two of the most common elements of bipartisan compromise, either normally it's either one or the other. This time it was both of them kind of coming into units in here to do some pretty, what will be cuts to key kind of welfare programs. Again, here's the common caveat. The catchphrase of the Democrats, "It could have been worse," is definitely true in this instance. And it was definitely pretty surprising that, I certainly thought it could have been worse. It was definitely pretty surprising that Joe Biden was able to kind of come out with the deal that he did. But it does not change the fact that definitely going to be a lot of pretty devastating cuts in here. Some of that is kind of still being haggled over, especially kind of the hits to the IRS and the SNAP program we talked about on the last show. But it still is a pretty pretty major win for the Biden administration here. This is from the New York Times, Carl Hulse. Senate vote came after an afternoon of closed-door talks to resolve a last-minute flare-up by Pentagon funding ignited by Republicans, who said the debt limit package severely underfunded the military. This is one that's adding funds to the military, just I don't think at the same rate was originally planned. Again, the military already, the single biggest spending item in our budget by far. Republicans, they were making that claim, but Senate leaders resolved the dispute with a formal statement that the debt limit deal does nothing to limit the Senate's ability to appropriate emergency supplemental funds to ensure our military capabilities. So if we really need to send more Pentagon money, I think they're actually going to work on a bill after this to, make that problem rectified, which is quite incredible. But the statement came after a day of uncertainty as a handful of Republican defense hawks complained the deal negotiated without input from the Senate would underfund the military, and they demanded a commitment that their concerns be addressed before it passed. And you can see Lindsey Graham, one of the biggest people there, for sure, by evening, Senate officials and Senator Lindsey Graham, who had been a chief critic of the Pentagon spending levels, that they weren't high enough, said the pledge from the leadership was sufficient to reassure him and other critics to back the bill, clearing the way for the final votes, saying it is a march in the right direction. Defaulting on a national debt is unacceptable and unthinkable, said Dick Durbin of Illinois, the number two Democrat, who accused McCarthy of a careless and reckless act. We cannot let it occur. So again, definitely some good stuff here on this bill to be kind of happy about. But I think Luke Savage and Jack have been making a pretty good point. We cannot see this situation, especially from the left. There was some good kind of plan no votes, kind of the phenomenon on the left. We see where they'll have some people, just for kind of public relations, vote against a bad bill, but have, a few kind of progressive lefties kind of break off just to give it enough support that it needs to pass. It's definitely one of these instances here. But one of, the better takes on this, I think, came from, we can go to now, Jacobin, where the debt ceiling is not victory. It's the piece, the title of the piece from Luke Savage. Centrist politicians have long adored the phrase, getting things done. There's some good, and one of the kind of old Beltway cliches, Washington politics cliches, there's some inherent good in getting things done. They've kind of adored the phrase largely because it's so devoid of actual content to centrist liberals. And as the bonus of being a handy cudgel to bludgeon a left, they insist is too puritanical. How many times have you heard that, purity politics, don't want to get things done. I'm sorry, not pure enough for you, Because how many times have we heard the purity politics, purity politics, this is some sort of a pope, but we actually got to get things done here. You're just being childish, to not want to increase the Pentagon budget by 10% every single year. Infantile progressivism cleaves to impractical ideas like people not being homeless or dying because they can't afford to see a doctor. Adult politics gets things done. So it's probably inevitable that the deal that Joe Biden and Kevin McCarthy struck to raise America's debt ceiling would radiate with some of the familiar rhetoric. Characteristics, Politico's write-up, which reports the circumstances surrounding the agreement with a dollop of dramatic flair, breathlessly revealing the extensive maneuvers in a political management that finally handed a major victory to Biden, the consummate dealmaker. Yeah, because this is also what it was. If it was some sort of hard right deal, it probably would not have been covered the same way. It was a very respectable deal in all senses of the word. It was done with Democrats and Republicans, and especially because, it cut entitlements. It cut,
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere. This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Really, entitlement is in exactly the right way. It wasn't too much. It was just around the, you know, the supplemental programs, the ones that no one really thinks about or cares about, especially inside the Beltway. Left, you know, the two big dogs of Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security alone. Just put, you know, a few more work requirements. Stop spending, which is a cut, but it can't actually truly be called a cut on paper. And of course, critically, still provided money to defense and didn't leave any of the actual priorities that Washington really cares about. Just completely left those untouched. This is from elsewhere in the media. The White House is unsurprisingly spinning it that way too. This kind of perfect compromise, perfect deal, etc. As ever, the whole thing falls apart when you look at what's actually in the deal or consider the alternatives to the periodic debt ceiling brokerage that there might have been. Democrats could have raised the debt ceiling at any time during their recent control of Congress and avoided the affair entirely. Just an unforgivable mistake. The debt ceiling being an unusual institution to begin with, they could have eliminated it altogether, an option Biden casually dismissed last October, deeming it irresponsible. Because again, the responsible thing is to sit down, make a deal, and cut entitlement programs just enough, but still spend money to defense. You know, that's the responsible thing to do. Biden was really always going to do it, and there again, that's what he did. Barring these, Biden could have simply invoked the 14th Amendment, which states the validity of the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned, and the government could have continued borrowing, like they are fully capable of doing. In lieu of these options, there is now a deal that prioritizes Republican cuts, adds Dickensian work requirements to food programs, and, by the way, worsens climate change, that we talked about on the Wednesday show, which, you know, is especially considering, again, this did not have to happen. That is really a big defeat. When asked about the deal's inevitable pushing of low-income Americans into hunger, Biden simply waved the claim away as a ridiculous assertion. He was asked about, apparently, I'm a concern among Hill Dems that the debt limit deal will lead some low-income Americans to go hungry, saying it is a ridiculous assertion. Just, again, waving that all off with the kind of typical kind of old man confidence that, you know, it looks so cool when, you know, it's doing something that you like, but when it's, waving off concerns about low-income people going hungry, maybe not the best of looks. So the debt ceiling deal, this is from the Center for Budget and... Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, said this: the debt ceiling agreement, which includes almost all of the supplemental nutrition assistance programs changes from the House passed debt ceiling and cuts bill, would put almost 750,000 adults aged 50 to 54 at risk of losing food assistance through an expansion of the existing failed SNAP work reporting requirement. The expansion of this requirement would take food assistance away from large numbers of people, including many of whom have serious barriers to employment. Something that was really not considered, and the idea that it will be completely cut out by the things they're doing to make it easier for homeless people and vets to get on is something that, you know, frankly, a lot of people are now saying is something that needs to be kind of a wait-and-see type situation because of the fact that it is, you know, very hard for those people who don't have many, or aren't always checking their email or maybe not even having a permanent address to, like, receive government mail to say, okay, you're now eligible to these things. You know, it's very, very possible that some of that stuff just may not even ever really be picked up upon. Which makes it pretty hard to at least celebrate for the moment. If nothing else, it's a timely reminder that for many of the most prominent people involved in deciding how America spends taxes, spends, and supports or doesn't support its citizens, all of this is barely more than theater. I think it's a really good point. The theater of it all, bipartisan play, you know, this negotiation theater kind of coming down the last minute. And I do kind of regret falling for it in a certain extent, you know. But I, you know, in kind of reflection, I would say I didn't really fall for it, but definitely kind of catastrophize about it a little bit more than what it actually turned out to be. But I think I was right in pointing out that the fact that, you know, we should not be here in the first place. The fact that this deal was brought up and the fact that
McCarthy was able to get any concessions at all, that in and of itself was a huge embarrassment. And the fact that, you know, there was some actually some major cuts to things like SNAP, you know, I think further proves that this was no victory, kind of a hollow victory, if anything, for Biden and his administration. But again, I think at the end of the day, he doesn't care really so much about people getting off of SNAP or whatever, or, you know, maybe a new pipeline being approved or whatever. Because, you know, at the end, he's like, I'm going to die soon, whatever. So probably what he's got at the back of his mind. But again, at the end of the day, they're just happy to do a deal.
It's the Spencer Walsh Radio Network.
Oh, see.
Going to park in the latest trap. Got stopped by a lady cop. She got me thinking I could date a cop. Cause her uniform fit me so tight. She read me down right. She put me in a pile. She caught up all the lights. She said I have the right to remain silent. Now I gotta holler. Sounding like a siren.
Some pretty dramatic news coming out of Australia today, courtesy of Ryan Grimm of the Intercept, talking about how the FBI has reopened an investigation into Australian journalist Julian Assange, according to the front page reporting from the Sydney Morning Herald. The surprise news is that the FBI is taking fresh investigative steps, and it was coming as also a bit of a surprise to Assange's legal team, given the U.S. filed charges against the WikiLeaks founder more than 3 years ago and is involved in an ongoing extradition process from maximum security prison so that he can be tried in the U.S. So, you know, essentially they had the case closed. You know, they had all the information they were going to have, but they're apparently reopening this case. Assange is charged under the Espionage Act with obtaining, possessing, and publishing classified information that exposed U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan, crimes that themselves have gone unpunished. And again, nobody ever talks about the crimes and actually punishing people for those crimes. You know, I didn't know one ever even knows who the crimes were, but we all know everything about the guy who has been smeared relentlessly to bring you information about these crimes at great personal risk to himself and also, by the way, to Chelsea Manning. The Morning Herald reporting also came amid heightened hopes in Australia that a resolution to the case, which had raised some serious press freedom issues in the U.S. and abroad, was near at hand. The country's ruling party has spoken in defense of Assange, as has the nation's opposition party leader, which is pretty surprising. In May, a cross-party delegation of influential Australian lawmakers met with U.S. Ambassador Caroline Kennedy, urging a deal be struck to return Assange to Australia before U.S.-Australian relations were harmed further by prosecution, which is going to be a kind of pretty interesting thing to see, that they're actually concerned about sticking up for the kind of press freedom aspect of it here, which is, you know, pretty surprising. You know, I think the reason why, if anything, is because if we think about it, what dog does Australia have in this fight? You know, the United States wants kind of Assange dealt with because he embarrassed them on the national stage by revealing their war crimes. The UK is kind of playing ball because the UK, especially the UK conservatives, are just kind of at the mercy of the United States and essentially willing to do, you know, we have the same kind of a security interest in arrangement. So we're essentially kind of the you know, you can fill in whatever kind of subservient, crude remark, crude remark indicating of subservience of one party to another that you want there. But essentially they do what they're told from the United States, especially on issues of national security. Honestly, Labour or Tory over there. But the Australians, they are kind of in an interesting situation because they're obviously long-held allies of the West, et cetera, et cetera. You know, definitely more historically closely tied with Great Britain and the United States. But, you know, especially in, you know, they have no really national security interests over this issue. They're not subservient to the U.S. in the way the U.K. is. They're not themselves getting embarrassed. They just know that one of their own citizens is being held potentially in a U.S. maximum security prison if this extradition process goes ahead as planned. And especially, you know, when they're kind of getting probably talked in their other ear by China, it's creating a pretty interesting situation. Grimm reports here that the U.S. has otherwise had a pretty rocky relationship, or kind of increasingly complicated relationship with Australia in recent weeks, even as it seeks to closer ties in order to compete with China in the region. Australia spent weeks preparing for Joe Biden to make a major visit to the nation in May, only to see him cancel the trip at the last minute to fly back from Japan to continue with debt ceiling negotiations. And this week, the U.S. also warned Australia that some of its military units may be ineligible to cooperate with U.S. forces due to their own alleged war crimes in Australia. That's pretty rich. It's not lost on the Australian public that Assange is being prosecuted for uncovering and publishing evidence of U.S. war crimes, which, you know, put the U.S. record against the Australian record. You know, I hate to be a little bit, you know, jingoistic here, but America will always come out on top. In May, the Sydney Morning Herald reported that the FBI had requested an interview with Andrew O'Hagan, who was brought on more than 10 years ago to work as a ghostwriter on Assange's autobiography. The FBI thought he would have been cooperative because O'Hagan's relationship with Assange had soured, as he had publicly criticized Assange as narcissistic and difficult to work with and published an unauthorized version in the London Review of Books instead. But O'Hagan told the Morning Herald that he was not willing to participate in the prosecution. I might have differences with Julian, but I utterly oppose all efforts to silence him, he said. In 2010 and 11, in conjunction with major papers around the world, WikiLeaks published documents and videos related to wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, evidence of war crimes, and other documents that exposed corruption on a grand scale. The disclosures helped trigger the Arab Spring, popular revolts against dictators, and popular revolts against dictators across the Mideast and North Africa. The Obama administration said that they had considered prosecuting Assange, but they didn't overcome the New York Times problem, which essentially says, you know, if he's publishing information and he gets prosecuted, why are we not prosecuting the Times that also would publish the same kind of classified information? Also, you know, going back to even the New York Times Supreme Court case with the Pentagon Papers, where they literally did receive approval to publish this classified information. So, the surprising thing, that was a problem that Trump had no problem with, you know, thinking about prosecuting the New York Times. But he led the turn back on the efforts to prosecute Assange. The case is now under the zealous guidance of Gordon Cromberg, a federal prosecutor in the Eastern District of Virginia, though the reopening of the investigation suggests the government has doubts that the case will hold up well in court. Coalition of major newspapers around the world has urged Biden to drop the charges against Assange. Yahoo News reported the Trump administration had also considered ways to kidnap or assassinate the journalist. So that'll be going to be a very interesting story to watch. That's all the time we got for today. Be back on Monday.